the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Now, it's fair to say we all like the sense of being sustainable and green and environmentally friendly and so on. But what about putting those things into practice? And how can AI, artificial intelligence specifically, show how we can all actually follow the example of our fantastic folk in the Netherlands and live a greener, more sustainable life? Well, we're delighted to welcome two fine folks to talk about this today. First of all, from the Netherlands Board of Tourism, Simone. How are you, Simone?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Excellent. And we've also got Margot as well from that perspective. Margot, would you like to just share with us again your own involvement with this fascinating notion of using AI to help us become more green and more sustainable?
Yes, sure. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Margot and I'm with the Dutch Cycling Embassy. And our mission is to make cycling accessible for everyone. With this AI tool, you can transform your own street, or actually every street around the world, to become a bike-friendly city. Just a street where you want to be, that's green, that's a happy place where people are just having fun.
Well, this is the key thing, because we've had a look at this particular AI tool, and as you said, it's not just for Amsterdam or Rotterdam or any of those other wonderful Dutch places, but you can use it probably even in the streets of Lincoln as well. So was that something you had in mind when you started developing this tool in the first place?
Yes, definitely. We felt that we wanted to share the great examples of Dutch cycling infrastructure and the Dutch lifestyle with the world, to show how you could make, say, Lincoln, for example, more cycling friendly, more pedestrian friendly, to have a greener environment, to have better air quality and a better lifestyle all round, and really to use the tool as a bit of a conversation starter to get people chatting and thinking about how could we make our streets or our city spaces more greener, like the Dutch.
I mean, Margot, obviously, as you said, from the Dutch Cycling Embassy, you have hosted Think Bike workshops in Albania, Vietnam, Canada, and the United States from that point of view. Do you feel the message is getting across, though, or is there still a reluctance to actually literally get on our bikes and actually use cycling as a mode of transport?
No, I feel like this vision of cycling is changing all over the world. So before, people thought cycling is only something that happens in the Netherlands, and oh yeah, you cycle because you're Dutch. But actually, this is changing. You already mentioned Albania. If you go to Tirana, it's amazing. Everyone is cycling there as well. There are beautiful bike lanes. And it's just such a good example that this can happen in every other city or town around the world. And this AI tool just helps you to envision that. It's quite difficult to see the parking lot in front of your house with different eyes. If it's always been that way, then it's difficult to imagine that this can also be a playground for kids, or that it can be a picnic bench where you can just have a barbecue with your friends, or you can just enjoy that area instead of just looking at a parking lot with a bunch of parked cars there.
Simone, artificial intelligence has got a bit of a bad reputation in certain instances, because people say, we can't cope, it's going to take over the world, it's like Terminator. And then when you add Google Street View and, of course, Dutch cycling experts, I'm sure there are people who will be panicking about this. I mean, how can you alleviate their concerns, Simone, and say, look, it's okay, it just works on your computer and it'll provide you with a whole insight into how your whole environment could change?
Yes, exactly. It's a tool there to just help your imagination fly. It's not coming for your city, don't worry. You're perfectly safe. But being safe is definitely the aim of the tool. So we use the tool to sort of show like how your street could be made safer for cycling. So with that in mind, definitely less vehicles, more space for pedestrians, more space for cycles, more space for greenery. So I think that it's brilliant when we can use something like AI for a positive outcome, and really just to get neighbourhoods together and to sort of chat. And that brings the human element to it. You know, it's not all hidden technology. It is about the human interaction at the end of the day.
DutchCyclingLifestyle.com, presumably, Margot, is the best place to go to actually put this into practice and actually have a look at it.
Yes, exactly. Or if that's too difficult to remember, just go to hollands.com and there you can find the tool as well.
Splendid. I mean, Margot, are you a regular cyclist, or is it a case of, no, I always actually use taxi?
No, in the Netherlands, we don't really think about cycling. It's just something that we do. It's just parked in front of your house. And whenever you go to the grocery store or to the doctor's or you go to school, you just hop on your bike and go wherever you want to go. And then it's also very conveniently if you see a nice coffee bar or a pub where you want to make a quick stop just before you go to your destination.
Clearly. Well, you're almost convincing me, and I have to confirm that neither Simone nor Margot are indeed artificial intelligence, at least we don't think they are. And I certainly don't think I am either. So good news from that point of view. And it is, as you said, DutchCyclingLifestyle.com to find out further details. Actually, Simone, are you also a keen cyclist, or is it a case of no, I like to have a rickshaw?
I'm a real advocate for cycling. I really can see that it brings so much benefits for kind of physical health, mental health, and obviously for the environment. I'm a commuter, so I go everywhere by train. But I can really, when I'm over in the Netherlands, I just see how amazing all the cycling is there. So I always say to people, it's such a safe way to get about in the Netherlands. Give it a try.
Okay, well, I suppose in Lincoln we've really only got the one steep hill to actually worry about,
Yeah,
whereas
that
two
steep
things
hill.
exactly, which is a steep, so yeah, says it by its own routine. And I think that's another issue for another time. But for the moment, Simone and of course Marco Daris from the Dutch Cycling Embassy, huge thanks and happy cycling, folks.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, there's some interesting news there in terms of using AI to actually green your spaces and actually cycle. Thanks to the Dutch, of course. Once again, the Netherlands leading the way. Okay, from there, from the Netherlands, we go directly to Ireland, Tipperary to be precise, for another Tipperary tale from Jenny Finch.
Hello there. This episode is from August 2022. When we moved here and retired, at least from full-time paid employment, we expected to have more free time. There are quiet days, but more often times when there is a bit too much going on. Take this last fortnight. A roller coaster of events and emotions have swept us up and left us a bit drained. The underlying emotion was sadness as we said goodbye to a close relative. As Jackie has not yet had an answer on whether we could travel, we couldn't attend the funeral, a source of great sadness. It does highlight one solitary good thing to come from COVID, however. The live streaming of these family ceremonies has become much more commonplace, and we were able to watch and say goodbye, even from another country. The weather has been very busy. Definitely a bit too much going on there. Cold, drizzle, and then bright sunlight swept over us seemingly at random. In the brighter intervals, Jackie hurried out and began the transformation of the wall that has replaced the old pump house. A dash into town helped us get the first of the bedding plants, and she filled the blocks as I tackled some of the more determined growth around the walls. The end result looks very promising, with a mix of flowers, including some pinks, my father's favourite. He showed me how to remove the side shoots and root them to make new plants, so we may have an impressive display in a few years. We were lulled into a false sense of security by the relative absence of flies this summer. They're still about, but in far fewer numbers. We attribute this to the removal of the Leylandii trees, fly tenements, all of them, and the new rules banning slurry splash plates. The latter, in particular, made life much better here. Unfortunately, the tiny biting flies seem unaffected, and as soon as we started working outside, we were bitten all over. The cry in the evening was, "How the hell did they get in there?" And I leave the rest to your imagination. So it's back to the naff-off bracelets, one of which Jackie has looped around the back of her cap to keep the little horrors off her neck. The garden and surroundings are full of life now. It appears the birds have decided we are fairly harmless and ignore us much of the time. In fact, I was filling the bird feeders and a goldfinch flew close enough to brush my face. He then sat on the top of the feeding frame and shouted at me, presumably to hurry up. He was down at the food before I was three steps away. Something has been pulling eggshells from our compost bin, and Fergus, our tree man, suggested it was a pine martin. He found pine martin scat on one of the walls, and the paw prints on the top of the bin match too. Pine martins can be fierce and territorial, so I'm careful about the dogs at night, but they also kill rats. So the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I also spotted a little shrew scuttling across the gravel drive, much to my delight. Less welcome was the sight of a tiny field mouse inside the back porch. It shot out of a rolled-up carpet and disappeared under the shelf, and I hope it left through the open doors. Certainly the dogs showed no interest in it, and Charlie has caught a mouse before. We love the variety of wildlife, but mice constitute a bit too much going on. We had several medical visits this fortnight as well, including another trip to the dentist at Ross Cray. After the frustrating and futile visits to the Limerick cardiac clinics, Jackie was transferred to the local hospital for follow-up care. A long-awaited appointment to see them proved to be more constructive than all the other clinics put together, with the exception of the nurse-led Limerick venue. In fact, the nurses have been wonderful throughout. This time, we got some answers. The young doctor listened and explained issues clearly and will push for a place on the rehabilitation programme they run. Overall, we felt a lot better about the situation, especially as she can dispense with some of the medication next month. There is some hope she may get better, despite the occasional days clouded by exhaustion and nauseous. Now, I know I promised you some details of the mower, but it's refused to start once again. I'll give it the once over again, but it's not reliable, and so we will look to trade it in as suitable for spares and do a part exchange. The little bit of cutting we managed was so easy and so quick, we really would benefit from having a mower to help the ongoing fight against Ireland's prolific green. Most of the rest of our time has been taken up by preparing for our first visitor. The spare room has been storage since we arrived, though we've been putting up shelves, assembling the bed, and sorting for a while. We were pushed into top gear by this imminent arrival, helped by IKEA, who very kindly sent the fixings for an Iver cupboard, something else lost by the idiot movers. I've done some of the work I failed to do before the move, filing important stuff, ordering books on shelves, and spending a lot of time going, what was I thinking? Once I got over the initial block, it was strangely liberating. So there we are, a strange, liberating and very busy few weeks with a bit too much going on. And suddenly, it's August again. So some things are the same as last year, and some are rather different. The schools are closed, of course, and the shops are now filled with families dragging around behind tired parents. Small children run up and down the supermarket aisles demanding toys or their choice of dinner. Here there are a lot of fathers doing the shopping, which may be laudable, but the less experienced slow down everything. I guess that's happening in Britain too. The weather has been rather more changeable than usual over here. It's August again, so it was blazing hot last week with glorious sunshine most days. The humidity is higher over here, and late afternoon and evening tend to be very sticky and uncomfortable. But the temperature was nowhere near as high as in parts of the UK. Then there was an enormous thunderstorm that was glorious in sound and light, so I'm told. I astonished Jackie by sleeping right through it, and now it is cool, grey and showery. It's actually quite a relief, and the garden and wood perked up immediately. This, however, came with two similarities to last year. Firstly, the flies are back. Not as many, in fact probably less than a quarter, but still a buzzing nuisance. We have a new mesh on the back door, And after some cunning work on Jackie's part, it is now firmly in place and thwarting most of them. The swarms from inside the house are mainly gone, though a few did hatch one night, probably from a window vent. They were all dead in the morning, and no more appeared, so I think we've solved that problem. The second repeat is the explosion of growth around us. Well, it is August, so the heat, the mix of rain and sunshine can be expected to encourage everything to grow and seed, unless curtailed fiercely. The tatty old mower's never worked properly, so we will trade it in for a different, hopefully lighter and more reliable model. These machines are very popular in Ireland, where cars and other vehicles are regularly kept for 10 to 15 years. If nothing else, it'll be a source of spare parts. In the meantime, I spent a few hours in the wood trying to remove the worst of the thistles before they seeded. I was partially successful, but came away with an interesting selection of insect bites. We had our first visitor this week, my niece, who was visiting Dublin with some friends. She hopped on a bus, and we picked her up a few hours later. This spurred me into action, cleaning and tidying the spare room. When we arrived, there was still too much stuff and not enough storage space, and so a lot of it, mainly textiles and my things, languished in boxes upstairs. It took a concerted effort, but the room was certainly fit for a visitor when she arrived, and a very happy few days were enjoyed by all. It was disrupted by another hospital appointment in Limerick, but as the weather was blazing hot, we let my niece off near the lake. She is a great walker and explored the area, sat in the shade with her feet in the water, and generally relaxed until we returned to collect her. And before there are any child abandonment concerns, she is a few years over 21, lived in Japan for 7 years, and is quite capable of looking after herself. For years, our least favourite month has been either November, gloomy, dreary and wet, or February, just beastly. Now I feel as if it's actually August here in Ireland. The weather is highly temperamental, either too hot or too stormy with nasty high humidity. The insects bite and swarm. The undergrowth becomes uncontrollable, and bad stuff happens in August. Last year, Jackie had her heart attacks, the absolute low spot of the year, of most years, actually. She is doing much better now, but recovery is slow and frustration. This August, I received the lovely news that my publisher, Impress Books, is about to go into administration. This could tie up my novels for months, leaving me with no way of selling anything. It also means the new book, A Long Shadow, is not going to be published, despite being under contract for 2 years now. I'm working on retrieving my rights and will be looking to make different arrangements, though I have all film and TV rights already. There are only a few Impress copies still around, however. I have some, and I am happy to sign and dedicate and sell if anyone is interested. There are still Kindles of the first three available if anyone wants one, but Smoke and Adders is only available as a paperback, so if you've not got one, grab it while you can. Well, it is August, so that's the month's roundup. Not a brilliant month, though it had some bright spots. The birds are already lining up on the telephone wires ready to leave, so let us hope September brings better news. Thank you for listening, and good wishes to you all as we slide into autumn.
Well, there we are, another classic Tipperary tale from little over a year ago, and clearly events continuing ever onwards. Any news, Jenny, on the publishing side of things?
I'm still exploring the idea of publishing A Long Shadow. I'm doing another edit just to make sure. It fell into the hands of an agent who obviously wanted me in the end to write her story and wanted me to move it to 2020, which is kind of problematic as there was no probation service then. So it needs a bit of revising, but I would very much like to get it out in the new year if I can manage it.
Excellent. Well, I was having a double feature with Author of the Week, because up next we'll be speaking to Dr. David D. Shine, whose text, Bad Deal for America, explores the high-stakes game United States politicians are playing with the taxpayers' money. The major players themselves, like a deck of cards, have shown us in their own words that the political system is broken. Readers can follow the money to see how some have lived high on the hog while masquerading as public servants. Told in an entertaining and unique way, this book is a call to arms to fulfill the ideals of the founding fathers by holding the political class responsible. So David Shine, I think obviously you've warmed up perfectly the audience for David and his quite interesting views on a bad deal for America. But never let me say that we can't actually have Jenny Finch getting involved with heavy politics as well. All good.
Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
When last we spoke to Dr. David Shine, we were speaking about, obviously, the era of America, the challenges of America towards the conclusion of his latest book in terms of the American dream, the whole essence of Bad Deal for America. He actually says the words, "I am not Pollyanna." Well, I don't know. He could be. But we're welcoming him back once again. It's a delight to connect with your good self. Lots of other things to talk about. Dr. David Shine, welcome back to the Author of the Week feature on the Midweek Drive.
Thank you. And it's always a pleasure to join you. And I do hope at some point to meet you in person.
Absolutely. Well, it could just be a ChatGPT avatar, of course. That's a different line entirely, which we talked about on our last discussion. But I was mindful, actually, when I was reading again your text, of course, the wonderful Bad Deal for America. I was minded of a former head of Channel 4 television who said that, from her perspective, the British were a people who staggered backwards into the future, looking longingly at the past. And I was just wondering, is that something which now America, even though it's a relatively young country, that there is this nostalgia for the founding fathers, that maybe actually in the past things weren't all as wonderful as they seem to be, and maybe pragmatism was the operative word even back in the days of the 18th and 19th centuries?
Gosh, that's a really fascinating topic. I have two observations. One of them is that we have gone through a period of roughly 5-6 years here of destroying monuments that were built to the past. So at one point, and even very revered founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson, people were removing his statues, and there was just crazy stuff. Christopher Columbus has become a pariah. And in fact, I lived near a park where there was a statue of Christopher Columbus. It was never fatally damaged, but it was splashed with paint often enough that the city has removed it and taken it to an unknown site. And so actually we've had a period of anti-nostalgia. Much of that is based on a concern of racism. And so that's from one standpoint. I think from a different standpoint, certainly that America does look back over its the last, say, 240, 250 years and says, you know, it seems like we did better in the past, and in a lot of different ways. One of them is that let's talk the 1960s. I remember the 1960s pretty well. I was a child at the time. But I remember that the Democrats and the Republicans weren't very far apart. The Republicans were kind of the, you know, more of the pro-business people. And sometimes people use the term silk stockings to describe the elite terms on Wall Street of law firms, but also to describe, you know, kind of the upscale culture. And when you got down to real life day-to-day issues, the Democrats and Republicans were not very far apart. And I think one of the pieces of nostalgia in the United States today is a feeling that we're, as a people, collectively, the collective term as a people, that we are, that we're awfully far apart in some ways. But, you know, you never have, you have to look at the headlines and then you have to look at the reality. I had a networking meeting on my schedule this morning, and I did make an appearance there before I came here. And one of my friends was there, and he is very concerned about the protests here in the United States, which are specifically referring to some of these college campuses, and the U.S. House itself had a protest, and that are pro-Hamas. And it's interesting because a very recent poll that came out last night said 76% of Americans support Israel. So you have the news, which is full of wild stuff happening at Hunter College in New York, and even Yeshiva, which is a Jewish university in New York City, having a protest for Hamas. But you have a statistic that says that the vast majority of Americans support Israel. So the question is, do you believe what you see in the headlines, or do you believe what the American people tell you? I, in my rather large circle of friends and family, do not have a single person in that circle that I'm personally aware of who is not supporting Israel. And the only people I've seen that are doing a better job of supporting Israel, I think, is your folks. And, you know, I'm pleased to see that. So, you know, sometimes we seem further apart than maybe we are.
I mean, the politics of division consistently seems to have been a part of the human experience. And I seem to recall that actually the symbol, the importance of a symbol, becomes vital. I mean, the whole notion of Uncle Sam, I often talk with my students about. I show them two images. I show them an image of Lord Kitchener pointing at the viewer, basically saying, "Your country needs you." And I show exactly the same image of Uncle Sam, and obviously ask the question, one of these is real, one of these is a fabrication. Is it a case of we need that symbol, that actually more than ever now we need a symbol of unity? Because if memory serves, Uncle Sam as a character kind of really emerged in the aftermath of the Civil War.
Yes. And my great hero from the 20th century was Winston Churchill. And I think Winston Churchill, who definitely had his detractors, understand that, you know, he rose to fame very, you know, during World War II. And yet was bounced out of office apparently very shortly after World War II, and then, you know, was brought back at some point and served another term or two. And so, but we had Winston Churchill in England, and for better or for worse, we had Franklin Roosevelt in the United States. And there was a unanimity. They were two people that during World War II, which I think was a period of the most consistent, the least acceptance of division. There were divisions, but they were largely, there was a certain sense of unanimity. Again, not completely accurate, but reasonably accurate.
And of course, we have the classic trivia that the D in Franklin D. Roosevelt doesn't stand for anything. It's just a D, which I always thought was quite amusing, really, from that point of view.
His middle name is Delano.
Oh, right. Oh, there must be another
Franklin
American
Delano
president.
Delano Roosevelt. And you know, when I'm asked sometimes about Roosevelt, because I didn't give, I did give him a passing grade, but I, as you know, as a university professor, I am considered a hard grader, by the way. But I didn't give him a super high grade. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is because what I call the deification of FDR, as we call him, Franklin Roosevelt, that he moved America very heavily in a pro-government, a big government direction, which Lyndon Johnson doubled down on. And a lot of the conservatives, if you will, or constitutionalists, are saying that our government has outgrown its usefulness. Not that we don't need government, but that the sheer size of government has reached a point where it's really not very effective. at doing basic stuff.
You mentioned a few of the presidents of the 50s, of course. Churchill was subsequently replaced by Anthony Eden, of course. And Anthony Eden came to a sticky end, really, post-Suez, which in many ways was, some might say, the official end of the British Empire when the ill-advised invasion of the of Egypt, together with France, effectively collapsed completely. But then there's another image which I'm often struck by, which is of the young President Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, and Harold Macmillan, who effectively took over from Anthony Eden. And it's almost as though you have really the onset of what we probably refer to now as the special relationship, in terms of Kennedy very much pointing towards the future, little, of course, realizing that he would come to a very traumatic end himself from that point of view.
Yes. I remember well.
Yeah. Again, another issue in terms of how the power of symbols. I mean, I'm often sort of I'm often mindful of the Santayana quote, "If you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat its mistakes."
Absolutely true.
Is that something which, again, you sort of think, yeah, that's why we need to call out when things are going wrong in the bicameral state of Washington, when you have two houses and you have got all of these situations that's there, it does need to be called out and held to accountability?
Well, the classic of a stunning lack of unity and divisiveness is happening as we are conducting this interview. They are conducting yet a third vote to see if Jim Jordan will attain 217 votes and become the next speaker. And I'm, as an American, aghast, I'm embarrassed, I'm frustrated that at a time of need, that these people can't see their, you know, can't see the light and just reach an agreement. This is not that complex an issue. I mean, the issues they're dealing with are complex, but hey, who's going to bang the gavel and say it's time to all show up for a vote? I mean, this is not that complex, folks. And if you can't agree on this, it bodes poorly. I can tell you that I have never seen as much support for my book, Bad Deal for America, which, of course, is an advocate for term limits. And it's like, you know, it's... I think we need some people with some breath. And one of the things I have projected is I do think that, you know, the United States has been dominated by two political parties, that I do think that some new political parties, the problem has been that oftentimes a upstart political party will end up costing votes to a party, and generally speaking, have not been able to get that momentum going to actually replace one of these two dominant parties.
I'm also mindful of not only the Bad Deal for America, but also the Decline of America, which you produced very effectively as an analysis of 17 US presidents from Woodrow Wilson right the way through Obama. 8 Democrats, 9 Republicans shaped the past 100 years. But you also raise the caveat that actually, you know, we need to look for the next 100 years before it becomes too late. And obviously, democracies can be very fragile at times, and it doesn't take a great deal to switch from a democracy one day to a completely totalitarian state the next.
Venezuela being an outstanding example of a country that has vast oil resources, at the time, a relatively educated and supportive population, how the switch turned and they've turned it into a mess where there's more people want to leave Venezuela than want to stay there. It's very sad. Another country of fair success is Thailand, that has its second or third military government over the last 20 years or so. And so you're correct that it's a very unfortunate situation. And the United States, given the difficulties in the House of Representatives, could indeed be on that type of cusp today.
Mm. we have spoken in the past about, obviously, the future, how that evolves, continues to develop. Politically, of course, in Britain, we've had a couple of by-elections recently, which, if they were to carry through to the logical conclusion, means we're heading to a Labour landslide in the next 12 to 14 months. Is that something where you look at Keir Starmer? Do you feel as though he is a valid leader for the world stage? Do you feel as though he could be somebody who could take the mantle from Rishi Sunak and perhaps lead away? Or is it a case of, well, the jury's still out?
Well, given it's a difficult question for me because I'm not there, but I can tell you that so far I'm supporting Sunak. I mean, the vision from my side of the pond is that, it seems that he's doing a lot of the right things, at least the view from, 30,000 feet, if you will. And so I would hope that they don't swing over to the Labour side. But, I really can't address that better because I don't know why people would swing over there. But I understand that England is facing some of the same financial issues that we're facing here, perhaps worse. The Biden administration triggered a huge inflationary shot, and then they've been trying to tamp it down. And so far, it hasn't been the inflation rate is definitely better, but it is not under control. And what is frustrating for me, a lot of people think about prices as a completely fungible thing. In other words, if I paid $1 for a loaf of bread 4 years ago, and then it went up to $2.50, that once we calm inflation, the loaf of bread will be a dollar again. What we're seeing and what people are observing on a day-to-day basis is that loaf of bread is still $2.50. It's just if you get inflation under control, it might not make it to $3.
Yeah.
But that's it's literal.
it's rather like certainly within the fuel industry, we have a line called rocket upwards, feather down, that petrol prices will actually shoot upwards and then they'll very softly, like a feather, just fall down to a sort of semi-reasonable level, but nothing like the level they used to be from that point of view. Let's talk the environment, because obviously we have a situation again in Britain, and I appreciate we're looking for your perspective on this, where the environment is very much to the fore. Greta Thunberg, of course, from Sweden, recently arrested. Lots of other issues in terms of the lives of that. Do you feel that has an echo with the 60s? Because from my understanding, certainly the whole ecological movement, even writers like Frank Herbert in the novel Dune, very much were addressing the issues relating to planetary ecology a good 50, 60 years ago.
Well, I'd like to share a personal perspective, because when I was a college student at the University of Pennsylvania, which is one of the most liberal schools in the country, and I was very much a duck out of water, and not a pitch here, but I am working on a book about my experience at Penn, those 4 years I was at Penn. I remember in biology that the biology professor, who was, of course, quite far out on the left, promoted a book called The Population Bomb. And it was a book that predicted that, and I think we had 5 billion people on Earth at that time. I think we're up to around 8 billion today, that we were running out of all of our resources and that we were, trashing the Earth. Now, here's my perspective. I am a young military dependent. My father was in the military, career military person. And I am the oldest of 7 children. And I tell you how uncomfortable I was to have this person saying, you're committing a sin against the humanity and against the Earth if you have children. And so I have a unique perspective on this from that very time period. But I remember Earth Day. The first Earth Day in the United States was in April 1970. I remember it personally. And one of the things that they did in Philadelphia was they set up recycling bins. And we used, almost everybody had a grocery bag. They were paper back then, a big paper bag by your front door. And you put your cans and your bottles and everything. And Philadelphia was a big beer drinking city. So they had, you would go to the local church. There was no curbside pickup like today. And you would put your brown beer bottles, your green beer bottles, and your clear bottles and your clear soda bottles in these big dumpsters, and they would take them away periodically. And then there was one for newspaper. So those were the things that got recycled at that time, glass and newspaper. I love recycling, and I may be a constitutionalist, so to speak, or conservative, but I love the efficiency and the concept of recycling. I think it's a fantastic idea. And we have made a lot of strides. The other one is in 1970, that horrible whack liberal Richard M. Nixon signed the Environmental Protection Act. And we achieved wonderful things for our environment, which we needed to do. You know, when the first colonists came from England, they came to the United States, and it was vast amounts of fresh water and fresh land in contrast to the crowded, the Dickinsonian streets of London, so to speak. And they said, well, this is wonderful. We have a great place to dump our sewage. We'll just dump it all here in this wonderful big river. And of course, sooner or later, they turned it into the streets of London rather quickly. And I remember I used to be a runner. I would run in downtown Houston, and there's a what they call a bayou here in the deep south. It's a stream that runs through downtown Houston. And it was so polluted in 1982 that there was no wildlife. There were no catfish, no turtles, no frogs. I mean, it was nothing. In the 5 years that I ran along the bayou, the Environmental Protection Act, which again was passed in 1970, but it had finally had its impact. And by 1988, there were catfish, frogs, turtles, and all that. So certainly a focus on the environment as avoiding pollution. Let's not pump horrible things into the air. Let's not dump terrible things in our rivers and streams. Let's come up with environmental ways to deal with solid waste. All of these things are very positive things, but does that mean that we all need to be driving electric vehicles? And I'm not sure that that's the right answer. And I'm concerned because I would like us to say, let's continue to improve the environment, but let's come up with the best practical solution. And I don't think the current electric cars, at least, are the correct answer, unfortunately.
Well, I'm sure you recall that at the start of the 21st century, the drive, no pun intended, was very much towards diesel cars as a environmentally friendly scenario. That didn't really end that well, I think, in terms of the take on many manufacturers and the push for going diesel. But that's another debate for another time. I'm also mindful that arguably in the 19th century, it was Malthus who actually had his notion of population increasing exponentially whilst food production increasing arithmetically, which meant we would be doomed, certainly again within living memory. So maybe we need to just keep the faith a little bit more when it comes to that, which is an optimistic line. We were speaking earlier in this particular hour to one of our writer colleagues from Tipperary, Jenny Finch, and she was giving her usual tale on Tipperary. We're looking forward very much to hopefully seeing you in 2024. Are there any other countries, David, that you've been keen to actually visit or you're keen to return to and so on, in terms of obviously as we promote the book, the text, etc., anything in terms of the world's tour of 2024 that you actually have in mind?
I actually am going to be in your neighborhood. I have been told by my better half who controls the travel schedule, and she's much more ambitious than I am, but we have already booked our plane tickets. We'll be flying to Edinburgh in very early May, and we will be in Scotland for the whole month of May. And we will be hitting as many high spots as we can from Edinburgh and Glasgow to the castles on the west side, to the bogs and to Orkney Island. So that's my next tour of the world.
Fantastic. And how is your book on Woodstock coming on? Because I know when last we spoke, you were having that as a sort of line that was going to focus, I think, on Woodstock. Is that also tying in with your own autobiographical
Oh, okay.
number?
Yeah. You have an interesting connection to the book. The book is called A Cheap Education, and it is about my 4 years at Penn, and it does start right after Woodstock, actually. Woodstock was in August, and I went to Penn in September. And I've just posted chapter 11 just recently. My chapters are very long. I'm on a writing site, believe it or not. There's something called Chapter Buzz where you can post your chapters as you write. I'm a little bit more cautious. You know, again, I am an attorney by training, and so I don't post whole chapters. But it's interesting because my colleagues are posting 1,000-word chapters, and I'm posting, you know, 1,500 and 1,800-word excerpts from my chapters. So I think I will be going through. But one of the things that I found in writing of this type is something I call data dump, is that you got to get the words in. You can edit until the cows come home, but if you don't start, if you don't get the words on the page. So I'm actually in that. And I wrote about 1,500 words several days ago, and I wrote 490 words the next day, and then no words on the book yesterday because I was in meetings. And you know, they actually expect me at the university to show up and teach class.
It's not so much the teaching class, but I think I could actually sympathize certainly with the number of meetings one has to attend where the sole purpose seems to be to set dates for further meetings. But that's another line entirely. I could go on a 3-hour meeting I was actually at on Wednesday, which I came out shaking one's head, basically thinking, really? We could have done that in 15 minutes, but never mind. No names, obviously. As we sort of continue to work through, obviously you're heading towards the period of Thanksgiving in the States, so that's just around the corner. Is that something which means a great deal to your good self, or is it a case of, no, I can't wait for Black Friday and then Cyber Monday?
Well, you know, a lot depends on, Thanksgiving is used by many people as a family gathering, and it has significance because it is a mega holiday here in the United States, independent of Black Friday, I mean, but it is actually more people travel in the United States for Thanksgiving than they do for Christmas. And so it is a nightmare at the airports. I'm very happy to say that I will be staying home. I've been told by my better half that we have an invitation to get dinner on Thanksgiving Day. And she was very happy because that meant we won't have to fix a dinner. But it is a big American tradition to go completely all out and to sit there and eat until you can literally not move away from the table. I've a bit moved away from that, but earlier in the season, I have spent time with my family. So I don't feel that I have to give on Thanksgiving because I've already been, I've been giving, you know, the cliche we have here is I gave at the office. And I think I've given it the office several times already this year. But it is a welcome a break. For me, it may be an opportunity to pen another couple chapters. Isn't that a wonderful cliche? To pen a couple more chapters for A Cheap Education. And we are planning to supplement, to re-release Decline of America. And I will tell you that we are waiting because we're pretty sure that Biden will not be standing for election. He is fading fast enough that we don't think that'll happen. I don't think they're going to take, the Democrats don't want to take him out of office at this point, but I don't think that they're going to actually run him. On the Trump side, an interesting legal development is that two attorneys who were part of the 17 defendants in this weird case in Georgia on election interference, Sidney Powell pled guilty yesterday. And part of that deal is that she would be testifying against the other defendants, which would include former President Trump. So the question is how much, while he's still way, way, way ahead in the polls, how much paint can you throw on that before it ends the run? So we don't want to release the book if either one of them is still in office, is the short version. But we will be adding chapters on Trump, Biden, and if neither one of them is the candidate in or gets elected in 2024, then we're shooting the re-release Decline of America under a new title and a new format in early 2025.
Fantastic. Of course, Ron DeSantis, once held as the natural successor for the Republican Party, seems to have kind of gone a lot quiet these days. Although I noticed that Hillary Clinton has decided to actually perk up as well above the parapet with some of her viewpoints about Trump getting reelected.
Well, DeSantis seems to be his own worst enemy in terms of politics. He's been enormously, enormously successful in Florida, and no one can take that away from him. The argument is that can he translate that to the big stage? And I can tell you that one of my personal favorites is Nikki Haley, who has been rising. She's certainly not competitive with Trump. I think it's possible she could catch DeSantis, depending on how things go. She's a very frank-speaking person. I think she has done something that may hurt her with the extreme right conservatives, but is the kind of thing that we were talking about a few minutes ago in terms of consensus, where she said recently, you know what, if you come out and you say that any abortion is completely banned in the United States, you're going to be preaching to a tiny, tiny percentage of the population, and you're not going to accomplish anything. And I think that my personal observation, and I'm personally religiously opposed to abortion, but I had my wife had an ectopic pregnancy, which she nearly died. It was at a time when there was not a concern of, oh my God, am I going to be sued under, you know, am I going to be criminally arrested under, you know, the law. And they analyzed the situation. They said it had reached an advanced stage. She was in enormous pain. And they took her in and they did the surgery at like midnight. They literally said, this is so critical. They went and did the surgery and she was fine and went on to have three children after that. So it was very successful. But the point is that we've got reports of doctors in certain states that are dithering about, can we do this and not get criminally arrested for, you know, things. So I think that I'm hopeful that we will reach a national compromise on abortion and put the issue away. And I do not like to see the health of mothers or the health of babies turn into a political football. So that's something that I think will be interesting. But anyway, she's taken a more moderate stand than some of the other Republican candidates.
David, it's always a delight sharing some thoughts, shooting the transatlantic breeze from Houston to Lincoln. But I have to ask you one other question, going back to the Biden presidency and administration. Will he still be adopting the policy of pardoning the turkey for Thanksgiving? Is that something which he will actually do as part of, you know, one of his major legacies?
I would say that the likelihood is rather high that the turkey will be pardoned. I don't think a president has failed to pardon the turkey so far.
Well, this is important because you never know with world events and various other bits and pieces. I was just a little bit concerned about that. A reminder, of course, that the text Bad Deal for America is available on Kindle. It's available on a whole variety of other platforms as well. From that point, it'd be well worth accessing and getting an insight in terms of the system as well. And as we've just heard, there will be an updated version, hopefully within the next couple of years, of the rewritten history of, I say the rewritten history, that sounds very dangerous, a loaded comment there, basically. a history of American presidents, the entitled The Decline of America, with, of course, a new title as well. So it will obviously sort of work on that sort of system. David, two final questions. I think you know what they are. Have you had a recently interesting Zoomer with us being number one?
Yes, it's always been a great experience. And of course, we're always very happy to let our listeners know I've got a growing social media audience, and we're always very happy to share with them our experiences with you.
And then the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to return? Will you come back in the not too distant future? Who knows? Certainly within the next few months.
That would be absolutely perfect, maybe after the turn of the year.
Dr. David Shine, huge thanks. And it's not too early to say this, so happy holidays.
Thank you so much, and to you and to yours.